For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. I'm Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and we have a really interesting and fabulously intelligent guest today, Mara Trumbauer. She's with Trademark, and Mara, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Before I was in the green room, I forgot. Did I pronounce your name correctly, Mara Trumbauer?
Mara, but that's I answer to both.
Okay, Mara. Okay. Then, Mara, tell us first a little bit about yourself, then a little bit about your company, and a little bit about that really great article that you wrote for us that people can find on 2sbdigest.com.
Sure. So my name is Mara Trumbauer. I work for CompuMark, which is the parent company of Trademark.com. I've been with the organization for about 5 years now. We're based in Boston, and we are a trademark research and protection company. So in my role, I've mainly focused on new markets. So when I first started at the organization, I spent most of my time in Asia-Pac, Latin America, and the Mideast, working with large corporations, boutique law firms, and some small businesses, designing our software programs to kind of fit their needs. And then about a year and a half ago, I transitioned into this new role, which was launching a small business monitoring solution, which is Trademark.com. So that's a new, I'm responsible for the business strategy for that product, and we've been live for about 4 months now.
Okay, and your website?
So our website's Trademark.com. You can find us there, and we offer kind of a two-prong approach to trademark protection and trademark registration. And the trademark registration right now that we're offering is through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And we do that through an industry partner called Marcaria. And Marcaria has a great network of attorneys that will help small business owners fill out their application, answer any questions that may come up, and really kind of guide them through the whole process so we can make it as easy as possible. And the kind of second prong to that is monitoring. And that's what we feel is the most important, because really to protect your brand, it's extremely important to have constant eyes on it. This is your baby. This is something you've spent your whole life developing. You want to protect it. So that's why we've spent a lot of time developing tools that will help you monitor this brand and protect it. And we'll send you basically a weekly alert that will notify you about potentially confusingly similar marks. And we'll give you some tools on how to protect them and kind of next steps.
Okay. Now, you've outlined it. Now, you're going to talk. 59% of our audience are presidents and or owners, and they're like me. I always thought that I could register my trademark simply by putting the R around it, that little R, and sending it into the patent office. But that's not the case. Am I hearing you correctly?
You're right. So you're all in. Trademarks is kind of a difficult topic, but there's something called common law rights. So if you start using your business name in commerce and you're doing business across state lines, technically you have a trademark and you have some protection. But if you actually spend the time to go out and register it with the U.S. Trademark and Patent Office, this gives you the broadest protection. This gives you federal level protection. So that way you can actually defend your mark. So if someone's actually using your mark, either could be in bad faith or maybe they don't realize your mark is out there, having that U.S. federal trademark is going to give you the strongest protection to go and fight that battle.
Okay. Well, again, I'd like to delve deeply into it because when I announced we were going to do this, I got a lot of gee whizzes, and good for you, because people are always unsure in this area. My company has three or four different, if you want to call them brand trademarks, we have developed, and one of them is over 20 years old. Now, are you saying that I registered by sending a letter to the patent office back in 2000, but that's not enough protection for me. If anybody wanted to take up the ISI logo.
So it may not be. So typically what you have to do is you need to either work with an attorney or you can go direct to the USPTO or you could go through a website like trademark.com and fill out a trademark application. This is a request. So it doesn't mean you actually have the trademark. You're just requesting to get this trademark. And a trademark examiner who works for the federal government will kind of review your application. As long as they don't see any issues with it, they will publish it for opposition. And that means that everyone else in the world will have an opportunity to claim stake to your trademark. So maybe someone else was using it beforehand. Maybe someone has filed something that may be similar and may confuse customers. And so this will give them an opportunity to, you know, fight that trademark. So that's when our monitoring service comes in handy, because that's what we'll notify you on. You know, you only have a 30-day period to do this. And there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of trademarks filed a year. So that's an overwhelming amount of data that you'd have to go through on your own. And so that's something that we automatically alert you to, anything that may be confusingly similar. So let's say that you get through that 30-day period and no one has opposed your trademark. It's about a 12-month process. By the time it's all done, you actually will own that trademark. But it gets a little more complicated than that. I mean, you have to show in use. You know, if you look at like a big brand like McDonald's, for instance, they recently lost the rights to their trademark Big Mac in the European Union because there was a fast food chain in Ireland that claimed stake to it. And they felt that McDonald's was not using the name Big Mac enough. And that's caused a lot of negative consequences for them. You know, if you look at, there was the Burger King in Sweden actually ran a campaign using kind of all sorts of negative things about the Big Mac. Like they said, you know, the burger Big Mac wished it was, you know, like a Big Mac, but actually bigger. They really took that trademark and used it against McDonald's for their own benefit. So that's why it's really important to monitor your trademark. It's, you can't just simply register it. You have to constantly monitor it to make sure no one's using it.
We are talking with Mara Trubor?
Trumbor.
Trubor. She is with trademark.com. I'm learning a lot, and I'm hoping our audience will, certainly learning how to pronounce her name correctly. Mara, in your story, and something we also say here at ISI, Small Business Digest, when you start a business, you have to have a lot of things in place. And if you're starting a new business, what do you tell them about trademark? What do you tell your clients?
So trademarks is a very important start of, you know, working with starting your business. Same thing as working with your accountant, working with an attorney. It's one of the first steps you need to take, you know, just like getting a domain name. You know, it's something that you have an opportunity, even if you're not ready to use that trademark right away, you can file something called an in-use application. But if you are already using that product or service, then you can just file a standard. And we have attorneys kind of, like I said, through our partner that can guide you through that. But it's a very important first step to take because, you know, consistency and making sure that brand is out there is everything to your business. I mean, that's how consumers find you. That's how they identify with you. And you have to protect that.
Well, but let's define what a trademark is. Is it
sure.
An icon, or is it a combination of words, like
so
McDonald's, obviously?
Yeah, okay. So a trademark can be a word, it can be a phrase, a symbol. It's something that identifies and distinguishes your goods and services from someone else. So it's, you know, it gets complicated to get namings. You can't be too descriptive in your name, and that's why it's always best to, you know, work with an attorney or someone like trademark.com that can connect you with an attorney so that they can guide you through that process.
Well,
you know, if you were an apple grower, you couldn't, you know, if you had apple in your name, that trademark's not going to be very strong and you may have a challenge registering that mark.
If you have an apple, please explain that.
So if you were a grower, yeah,
understand.
So it's best to call it, you know, sunshine fruits or something, you know, that would be a stronger trademark than calling.
Really? Why would that be?
Because you don't want to be too descriptive. You need to have a strong trademark that doesn't, it's not, the less descriptive it is, the stronger it is, because that way a consumer won't confuse you with others.
Oh, so you're saying, well, Apple is descriptive, but Froops is a nominative, is what you're saying. Am I hearing you right?
You're right. No, naming can get complicated, and that's why we always kind of refer people to attorneys who can really kind of guide you through that process.
Well, you know, the name of our parent company is Information Strategies, Inc., and mm-hmm. under that we have things like Small Business Digest. But there is also a much bigger company called Information Strategies, Inc. in Washington, which is 100 times bigger than us. And they have never come after. We're often confused for them. And it's always been an interesting question to us. We predate them, and we've never said anything to them. Does that happen often in your line of work, where someone has a name like that, and a bigger company comes in and tries to take it?
So it can happen. I mean, it's a difficult situation. I mean, there was a recent, I don't know if where you are, if you've heard of a company called Milk Bar. They're a big sort of dessert chain that's in New York, but they recently sued another company in Chicago called JoJo's Milk Bar. And the reason why they did that was because JoJo's was really kind of out there kind of actively confusing customers. They had a very similar name. They were using a very similar script, like a cursive font, to spell out Milk Bar. And they were selling related services, so lots of very like bright and colorful desserts. They had a very similar business model. And because Milk Bar has a very large kind of cult following in the U.S. that's growing, they have about 16 locations, they were very offended by this, and they went after them. And Milk Bar, JoJo's Milk Bar, filed the trademark. Milk Bar did see that published for opposition, like I talked about earlier, how you have that 30-day time period. They noticed that trademark was filed for, and they sued them. They filed for opposition, and they're claiming loss of revenue, customer confusion, and that's something that JoJo's Milk Bar now has to pay back. So it can be very costly to do that. But there are circumstances out there where two similar names can coexist, and that's just something that, you know, through attorneys sometimes you can work through, or sometimes that large corporation may, you know, your organization may have chosen just not to take action, but it's always best to take action, because if something did happen and you were experiencing loss of revenue, the fact that you haven't gone out and really kind of pushed the issue and kind of fought for your brand, it really dilutes it in the market. And a trademark examiner will see inconsistencies, and they'll see that maybe you didn't, you know, invest in your brand enough to really fight it. So we always suggest fighting for your brand, because in the long run, it's everything to you. And there's things you can do ahead of time. You don't have to get into costly litigation. You can work with an attorney who can help send a letter. You can send a cease and desist letter, you know, file for opposition. It kind of builds up to big court cases.
Or in our case, we can coexist because we're in different
coexist,
industries.
Coexist, happily, right. And that does happen.
Okay. Let me give you we were talking with Mara. Mara Trumbore.
Trumbore, that's okay. It's a tricky one.
Mara Trumbore, excuse me. She's with trademark.com. But years ago, now over 20 years, when the keto diet first came out, I was part of litigation when Keto, the original company, went after another company that offered the same types of products. But what they did is say it was, and I've forgotten, the John Brown Keto Company. But what they did was they made the packaging almost identical to the mm-hmm. keto packaging. Now, that's not kosher. Am I correct?
Correct.
But the idea is you have to find them doing it first before you can go after them, and that's where you come in. Am I hearing that
exactly
correctly?
Exactly, and that's where we'll come in to help brand owners, as we'll alert them anytime a new copycat or potentially confusing trademark is trying to enter the market. We're going to give you this weekly report that's going to give you an overview of any possible marks that may be confusing in the market. And then we give you some tools that will help you how to best tackle that. You know, like I said, whether that's just simply sending a letter or whether that's filing for opposition, there's all different kind of levels depending on where you are in the process.
Well, Mara, but how do you keep track of all the millions of things that are happening in the marketplace?
So we only focus on trademarks. So we look strictly at these published gazettes that happen. So every day the U.S. Trademark and Patent Office puts out a gazette that's on their website, and it contains hundreds of trademarks. So over the years, like I said, we're backed by CompuMark, who is the world leader in trademark research and protection. So we have developed an algorithm that actually looks at each gazette that comes out, and we pull this data, we compare that data, your trademark, to the trademark found in the gazette, and we pull out anything that might be confusingly similar.
That must take an awful lot of computing power.
It does. We've spent years developing it.
So I guess, but how do you do with someone like in the keto example, where the trademark, by the way, only said Johnson Brown. I forgot the other company now. And the only way they picked it up was when they saw the packaging. Do you help them see the competitive packaging designs as well?
So at this time, we don't, and that's just because packaging is not something that's necessarily registered. That's something that's monitored through, you know, some people may use something like a Google alert that'll set up packaging that'll look at marketplaces. You know, and that's one thing that we're doing as owners of this product is we're looking for feedback from the market. So if we're hearing that people are looking for solutions to help monitor marketplaces or packaging, those are things that we're looking to add down the line to this product. But for right now, we're focusing on just monitoring the actual trademark applications.
So John Smith decides to go into business and comes up with a great title, Whiz 2, to use an example. They go to you and say, help me register it and also protect it. Am I hearing it correctly? That's how it's done?
Yes, that's how the process starts, is we'd help you fill out an application for that Whiz 2 trademark. That would get submitted to the USPTO. And while you're filling out that application and submitting it, you'd also be signing up to monitor your mark. And that's very important to do from the start, because that's when there's constantly people always coming into the market, especially if you're in a crowded market space. You want to constantly have eyes on any newcomers coming in, because that may be trying to leverage your brand that you've been using out there.
Well, again, I don't want to confuse, but I want to understand. A couple of days ago, the Wall Street Journal reported on the fact that people who go on the program, the Shark program.
Which oh, Shark Tank, yes.
And they display a product. People, they oftentimes have knockoffs appearing often before they've even gone to market. Do you? And they talked about one, which was a new pacifier. But do you also try to help if they come up with a pacifier that's called a bubble pacifier, help them identify products that are similar or knockoff?
So we don't work in the, you know, patent space with actual products. It's more of the naming. So if someone else came up with like a bubble sucker or something, you know, that's something that we could help them with actual naming. But in terms of the actual shape and design of the product, that's a patent related. And that's something that we do.
I recognize that. But what they were saying that in Europe, they were calling it almost the same thing. And we're knocking off the product. So do you help them with similar like names or Can you help them identify?
Yeah. So we would help with similar names. And in Europe, what they have is they have something called trade dress, which can be like the shape of a product. So we do have, you know, some services kind of at our core level that does that, that we could potentially help someone with. But for now, like trademark.com, like I said, is really just focused on the naming side.
Hmm. Your website again, and how people, if they wanted to reach you, Mara, can
sure.
do it?
Sure. So our website is trademark.com, and they can reach out through Mara, M-A-R-A, .trumbor, T-R-U-M-B-O-U-R, at trademark.com. Or if my name's too difficult, they could always reach out to customerservice@trademark.com.
Okay. Mara, let's talk. Let's say we have a website, Wiz2, and we and someone else uses decides to use a similar website, Wiz2A. Do you help also in that area, or is that again a different area?
So again, that's a little bit of a different area. You know, that's something that what we do help with. Is kind of in the initial stage. So, for instance, when you were beginning the process and coming up with Wiz2, we also offer you to trademark searching on trademark.com, and that's something that we should touch on very quickly. And what trademark searching is, this is kind of before you pursue that trademark. It's doing a kind of a quick search, making sure that no one else is using that name that is in the same market segment as you, offering the same goods or service. So we offer kind of a free search where you can just enter your trademark, describe the product or service that you're offering, and we'll bring back results. And one of the results that we bring back are domain names. So if someone else had already registered, you know, Wiz2, we'd let you know that. So that way you have, you're familiar with that, what's out in the market, so that you as a brand owner can do your due diligence to make sure you're not infringing on those rights. But we don't actually help with domain registration. You know, you'd have to go to a domain register, like a GoDaddy.
Hmm. But you do provide a very valuable service.
We do, and it's very important, you know, to start that process out, you know, to make sure no one else is out there using that trademark before you proceed down that road, because that's, again, you know, how you avoid lengthy court battles, because, you know, that's a significant time sink for you as a small business owner.
We have just a few minutes left, Mara, but there are two or three things you suggested in your article on our website. Would you repeat them for our audience, warning when starting a new business, or even for that matter, continuing a business, that you'd like to pass on to our audience?
Yes, I mean, I think the most important thing is, you know, it's very important to monitor your brand at all times, you know, search those trademarks in consistency. You know, copycats are out in the market all the time, especially when you're in a crowded space. So anytime you're out there, it's very important to be proactive and have consistency in the market, because that's going to really build your brand and keep it strong.
Mara, what do you do when there's a similar name but in a different industry, like the case with ISI?
Right.
In Washington. Well, what
so
do you do in a case like that?
Yeah, in those situations, you know, it really depends on the circumstances. But in most cases, you can coexist out in the market because you're not going to be causing a lot of confusion. The only time that could happen is if you're a famous mark, you know, if you're like a McDonald's, a Sony, an Apple, a big brand that everyone knows, that's where you're going to run into a problem where if you're operating in different segments, you could cause confusion, and you may think that that other company may be endorsing you or part of you.
Well, let me ask you this question. What if it's a dormant trademark? What if the trademark hasn't been, you know, can you talk to that?
If it's a dormant trademark, if it hasn't been used?
Yes. Well, let's say it just came up recently that a trademark had not been used in the public place in 25 years, and no one can find out who owns it at this point. Can you can't assume it or anything, can you?
So So you may be able to. I mean, if a trademark's been out there for 20 years and no one's used it, you haven't heard of it, chances are it's no longer an active trademark. Just kind of going back to that McDonald's example, McDonald's lost the rights in the European Union to Big Mac because they were unable to prove consistent use in that market in Ireland. But they maybe did in France, but they had to show consistent use everywhere. And that's the same thing for the U.S. You have to actively use your trademark. You can't just file for a bunch of trademarks and have them sit there. You actually have to go out and use that brand in the marketplace to continue to have rights.
Well, that's very interesting because, again, just came across my computer, somebody asking that question. It's fascinating. How did you get into the trademark business?
So I got into it. I came from a marketing background. I worked with a marketing agency, so kind of was a marketing and branding kind of go hand in hand.
And do you find that? Do you think that? What do you think is going to be the future of branding in this age where we have all of these multimedia?
It is no, it's a very exciting industry to be in because there's so many new technologies coming onto the scene, and I think the future is very kind of a do-it-yourself model. You know, really giving tools to consumers to do the work on their own. You know, and that's kind of like going back to what we talked about where we're giving you tools, you know, to register your trademark, you know, set up monitoring and really protect your business. Like those kind of three portals, like that's where that industry is going. Like these are the three main pillars and just providing tools to consumers to empower them to do it on their own.
Maritime,
you know, and attorneys have a very important role in this. It's just especially when you go down market to small businesses, budgets are limited, time is limited. They're looking for tools to just kind of put this into the market and start running their business. And they may not have a lot of funds available to work with large intellectual property law firms. So that's why we're trying to bring our expertise down market to help small businesses.
Well, you're doing a great job of explaining it to our audience. Mara Trumbore. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us on today. We really appreciate it.
Okay, and remember, your article is on 2SB Digest as we speak, and a link to your website, Trademark, will be on our website tonight. Mara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Don.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes, hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of the shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. I'm Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and we have a fascinating guest today, Breanne Joseph. She's head of a Sly Fox private investigation. And when I saw a little notice about her, we had to have her on the program. Breanne, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we ask all our guests, tell us first a little bit about your personal background, then a little bit about your agency, and then finally your website.
Sure. So I am the owner and head investigator at Sly Fox Investigations, which is an all-female detective agency in Louisiana. I was born and raised in New Orleans, and I moved to Baton Rouge due to Hurricane Katrina. And our agency is headquartered in Baton Rouge, but we also have an office in New Orleans. The agency specializes in surveillance for insurance fraud, for infidelity, for child custody. We also do process service, and we interview witnesses and locate witnesses as well.
But Breanne, what made you get into the private investigation field in the first place?
Well, when I started, I was visiting actually a detective agency. A relative of mine worked at a detective agency, and I was visiting, and the detective at the time was having some kind of difficulty getting some information over the phone. So jokingly at first, I said, well, hey, let me help you. Let me try to get the information. And he reluctantly let me make the attempt, and I was successful with it. And, you know, I asked him to let me be an apprentice and to learn the ropes and teach me more about the industry because I was just really intrigued about it. And he agreed, and I became an apprentice, and that's pretty much where I learned the ropes. And once I realized just how great women were in this field, I decided that I could just branch off and start my own agency and teach other women how to do what I did.
So now you have five people in your organization besides yourself?
Yes, we have five female investigators that specialize in surveillance.
Oh, okay. Well, I have a lot of questions, I'm sure, for our audience, but I guess my first one would be, what do you look for in an employee that can be a good investigator for you?
Well, I think, what's important is for someone who is just relentless, and especially for private investigation, because sometimes you get a lot of dead ends and a lot of dead, situations where there aren't many options. And a lot of times where investigators fail is that they give up much too quickly. So we look for someone who is relentless in their pursuit of the information, for one, and someone who's just naturally detail-oriented and inquisitive. And, we like to joke around and say somebody who's nosy. But nosy people do really well with what we do. So we look for people who are physically fit as well. Surveillance is very taxing sometimes. We wake up sometimes at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'll set up in the neighborhood, and we may not get activity until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you can imagine how difficult that would be for someone to just sit in a vehicle in, the entire day. You have to be able to physically to do that as well. So at the very minimum, that would be the requirement to be able to do this type of work successfully.
Well, I have a lot of questions. First, what is your website for people who are interested?
Sure. Our website is flyfoxinvestigations.com, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/flyfoxinvestigations.
This is radio. Will you spell out Sly Fox for our audience?
Yes. Sly Fox is S as in Sam, L, Y as in yellow, and then Fox, F as in Frank, O-X, and then investigations.com.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of questions. My first one I always ask small business, what impelled you to jump off the cliff and start your own business?
Well, I decided to jump off the cliff because I just recognized my own skill set and my own ability. So, you know, in entrepreneurship, you know, nothing's ever guaranteed, but you just have to kind of trust your gut, you know, and take that leap of faith sometimes and just have the courage to just step out on your own. But for me, you know, I knew that I was really good at what I did, and I knew that I could make much more money for myself if I were to just step out on my own and just do it myself.
How long have you been, has your agency?
Yes, we've been licensed in the state of Louisiana for 14 years now.
Well, so you're certainly over that five-year hump. And you know, when we look on television, we see all these private detectives in there. Usually they're male. I think Honey West is going way back as the only private investigator I know that was female. But I guess my next question is, what are the advantages of being a woman in an industry that's so male-dominated?
Yeah, you know, there are approximately 60,000 or so PIs in the United States today, and only 15% are women. So there's not a lot of women who do this. And there's only 3% who are African-American women. So I'm really the minority in the industry. But, you know, I think all women make great investigators. And some of the advantages that we have is that, you know, women are just, we just physically appear less threatening than men in a lot of situations. You know, if I'm following someone and, for example, if they get out and they walk into a Walmart and I follow them inside Walmart, nobody's going to turn around and look at me and say, private investigator. You know, we don't look like investigators, for one. But not only that, there was a situation where in St. Charles Parish in Louisiana, there was a young guy who had broken into an elderly woman's home, and he ended up murdering her. It was some kind of horrific thing that he did. I think he might have hit her with the microwave or something, but she, you know, she ended up dying from her injuries. And they had hired a male investigator to try to get the statement from him and try to talk to him and get information. But the guy was like 15 or 16 years old, and he just didn't talk. He didn't want to talk to the male investigator. So long story short, they ended up contacting me, and I went over to the parish, and I was able to establish some type of rapport with him, and he eventually gave me the statement. He just was more comfortable talking to a woman about what happened, you know, for whatever his personal reasons were. But that's just an example of how women can have a slight advantage over male investigators in this industry.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't realize until you said it that you're African American. Is your entire staff African American, or is it does it have other than African Americans?
Yes. No. We have different races and ethnicities in our agency. We have a Latino investigator. We have a white investigator. We have all different types of investigators, and which is awesome for us because, you know, a lot of times we have to blend in different environments, and so it's always good to have different investigators that can fit in these environments easily.
Well, how do you get your referrals? How do you get your cases?
Well, the majority of our cases come from attorneys. The majority of the work that we do is insurance fraud work. And, you know, we do insurance fraud, automobile insurance fraud investigations, as well as workers' comp fraud investigations, you know, which is basically when people are hurt on the job and they claim they can't work anymore. You know, the attorneys will call us and say, hey, well, you know, we have some doubts about this situation. Would you send an investigator over there to check this person out? And so when they have that doubt, we'll send someone over and they'll document his or her activities and interactions and report that back to the attorneys. And we do that mostly for insurance fraud regarding the automobile accidents, just like when people frame or create fraudulent scenarios and stage accidents just to get a check. So they'll call us and, you know, they'll have a claim that they can't get out the bed and they can't do anything. And then we'll go out there and we'll get video of them in the street playing football or something, you know, something that kind of negates the claim. Now, granted, a lot of times many of the claimants are really hurt, you know, and that's not to say that people who have these claims are never hurt. Many times they are actually hurt. But what we find is that a lot of times it's just really not to the extent that they claim. So, you know, the person could be hurt, but they could actually get out the bed and could possibly go to work if they really wanted to. But they're just deciding to kind of to cheat the system a little bit. So that's when the attorneys will call us to try to figure things out for them.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Breanne Joseph. Her agency is Sly Fox Investigations. It's at slyfoxinvestigations.com. We've never had a private investigator on our program. So I guess my next question, can you give us an unusual case that you worked on?
Well, there's so many different cases. A lot of them, the most unusual ones, I guess, would be, you know, some of the infidelity cases can get pretty crazy. We do insurance fraud, but we also do infidelity cases and child custody cases as well. But I don't know, the craziest case, what's coming to mind, I guess, is there's one case where the husband actually hired us because the wife was allegedly leaving her job on her lunch break and meeting up with some guy, and he wanted us to try to confirm that. So we set up surveillance at the house, and sure enough, the woman came to the house. A few minutes later, there was a guy that showed up, and she went into the front door. She apparently left the door open for him because he walked right up the porch and walked right into the house. And so we're getting the footage. We're getting the documentation of that they're actually in the house. So now our contract states that, you know, our clients are not supposed to show up on the scene of an investigation. But apparently the client that we had that day didn't care about that stipulation, because the next thing you know, he comes rolling up and he's parked his car and he sees the other guy there. So he goes into the house and we videotape him going in the house. But the craziest part about this is that it was a two-story house. And shortly after the husband entered the house, the second story window opened. Now, mind you, there was no balcony. It was just the window, right? So, you know, we pan our camera up to the window to see who was going to look out the window, and it was her lover. And he kept looking back and forth outside and into the house. I guess he was, anticipating the husband coming up or trying to decide if it was in his best interest to jump or not. And, you know, we're just thinking, I know this guy is not going to jump because there's no balcony. I know he's not going to jump. And you know what? He actually jumped out of the window and he hit the ground so hard that he apparently hurt himself because he couldn't get up. So he's trying to get up and he's like dragging his leg across the ground. By that time, the husband comes out the door and he beats the crap out of him. We get it all on tape. And all the neighbors are outside at this point. The police are called, and it was just a lot of drama. So those are the types of things that we see on infidelity cases, unfortunately, sometimes. They do get a little crazy.
I'm sure they do. We're talking to Breanne Joseph. Her company is Sly Fox. It's in investigations. It's in Louisiana. Do you just stay in Louisiana, or do you work other states?
Well, we're licensed in the entire state of Louisiana. We work the whole state of Louisiana, but we also work in the state of Mississippi as well.
Well, You mentioned child custody. That's always of interest because you're always worried the effect on the child. What do you do in case like that? Try to find out that the child is not being properly treated? What do you do in cases like that?
Well, the great thing about our agency, you know, we love working the insurance fraud cases, but, you know, being an all-female agency, we are all parents, we're mothers. So child custody cases, we really take to heart. You know, we believe that children are the most vulnerable members of our society. And as investigators and as mothers, we do everything we can to help keep them out of harmful situations. And we feel like we have just an innate obligation to keep them safe and protected. And a lot of things that we do, or one of the things that we do to help protect children, you know, for example, someone may hire us if they believe their child's other parent is bringing their child around suspicious people. We would do background checks on the individuals to see perhaps if they have some type of criminal record or perhaps they were a pedophile. You know, there's a lot of different things you can uncover in a background check about people that may influence the decision of the judge as to whether or not that child is safe in that environment. You know, we are also hired just to see perhaps if there are violations of a custody order. Sometimes a judge may order that the parent is the only person who should keep the child. But we'll find that, you know, we're hired on a case, and during the child's visitation to the parent, they're not actually keeping the child. What they'll do is they'll bring the child by a friend or a relative and then just party for the whole weekend. So they're actually not keeping, you know, the child, or they're not allowed to have visitors spend the night at the home. And so we help prove those things as well. We also help prove drug and alcohol abuse, which can definitely be a difficult thing to prove. But, you know, we do have strategies and techniques that we use to help establish that. And all of these things, you know, we do testify in court and we present all of this information to the judge. And it just helps the judge decide ultimately what's in the best interest for the child.
Well, are your cases protected? If I hire you, is what you find protected in any way, or can the police or the other counsel have gain access to it?
Well, you know, what happens is if there is, for example, surveillance footage, incriminating surveillance footage, you know, that could actually be discovered in the discovery process during litigation. That happens a lot, especially with like insurance fraud cases. But confidentiality is extremely important for our clients and for our agency. So details of the case are not discussed with anyone outside of the client relationship that we have. The only time a video would be shared is if it's court ordered, and usually in the discovery process, that's where that would happen.
But you also serve summonses and court cases where someone needs to make sure that someone is served with a court order, et cetera. Do you do that as well?
Yes. Our agency also specializes in process service, and we really do well with individuals who are avoiding service. We actually have a couple of those cases open right now where you have people who may not want to pay child support. And so, you know, parents who are owed child support, you know, they may have people who lie for them and say, they don't live here, or you have the wrong address. They're just really, you know, evading service. And so we do really well with those types of cases because, again, you know, people don't suspect us. If we knock on the door, you know, we don't look like the sheriff or anybody, you know, in a policeman or anything like that. So people typically have their guards down and they open the door for us. And even for the more difficult cases where they won't open the door, you know, we'll stake out the residence. you know, we'll just set up surveillance and get them when they come out. We've served people at gas stations. We serve them at a red light. It really doesn't matter to us where we serve them at. But, you know, we definitely get the job done when it comes to process service because they just don't suspect us.
We're talking with Breanne Joseph. The name of her private detective agency is Sly Fox Investigations. Let's talk about how do you market your services?
Well, what works best for us is direct mail marketing. That's what we've been using for several years within our attorney network. But a lot of our business actually comes just from referrals within that network from other attorneys who we've done a great job for. They send us tons of business just through word of mouth. But for efforts on our part, we do a lot of direct mail marketing. That works really well for us.
Hmm. Well, you know, you've been in business for 14 years. How do you expect to grow?
Well, one of the things that we're starting to do is market more online and use social media to connect with our audiences. Previously, you know, as I mentioned before, the majority of our work would come from attorneys. Our attorney clients are not on Facebook. We can't market to them on Facebook, but the general public is on Facebook. And so that's where we actually this year we started shifting more toward that audience for child custody and infidelity cases. And, you know, that's what we're actually currently in the process of doing is marketing more using social media channels to reach out to the child custody and infidelity cases that we can market to online.
Well, I'm curious because you're on. But is that do you see a trend upwards or downwards in cases like that? Is there, in your opinion, more infidelity, or is it just what's your feel about the trends?
Well, I mean, I think private investigation in general is really a cyclical industry. You know, we're super, super busy, and then it slows down a little bit, and it's super, super busy again. The industry itself is very cyclical. But being that we've always specialized in insurance fraud, that work in itself has remained consistent with us. And, you know, the infidelity cases and child custody cases that we are getting have been pretty consistent now. And it's all really because of the marketing efforts that we've put in place kind of in the beginning of the year, which was our intentional way of driving traffic to us for those specific types of cases. But they've been pretty consistent so far.
I guess my next question, I have so many, is how do you see the future of a company like yours? The big guys, the Pinkertons of this world, seem to be trying to acquire each other, big companies. You're a small company. What's your niche?
Well, in surveillance is actually our niche. And that's the great thing about our agency, because surveillance is very difficult to do. And not a lot of women do it for that very reason. And so, you know, that's definitely a niche market for us. Most investigators, they would do things like, you know, locate long lost relatives or find somebody's birth parents or things like that. Those are more common types of private investigation, you know, things that people can do. Surveillance is typically a male job in this industry, but that's what I started in. So that's what I learned first, and that's what I got good at. And so that's what my agency specializes in now. But, you know, we are definitely growing, and we're going in the right direction. And hopefully in the near future, we'd be able to perhaps expand to other cities. We have a lot of different opportunities that are coming our way that we plan to take advantage of. Actually, last week, we were invited to the Louisiana Senate floor, and we received an award on the Senate floor for being the largest and the only all-female detective agency in Louisiana, and also for our efforts towards women's empowerment in Louisiana. So they gave us an award for that last week. And so, you know, a lot of people are recognizing our excellence in the field, and it's definitely helping us grow in that regard, too. I'm a women's empowerment speaker, and another thing that's important to our brand is helping other women, you know, just come from the back seat and take the wheel and drive off and do things that are not typical for their industries, like what we're doing. There was a Women's Empowerment Summit that came to New Orleans last month. It was the One Women's Global Power Summit. And I was one of the featured speakers there. And that's one of the ways that we give back as an agency, is by encouraging other women to step towards entrepreneurship, you know, and just to actualize their dreams. And we take pride in doing that as well.
Okay. We're talking with Breanne Joseph. Her company is Sly Fox Investigations in Louisiana. Breanne, we have just 1 minute left. What would you like to leave with our audience?
I would just like to encourage everyone to visit our website, sign up for our new blog. We're going to be giving a lot of tips about how to keep your children safe that many people are finding very valuable. We have a new YouTube channel that we've just launched as well. We invite you guys to check that out. And we love to have you check us out on social media, specifically Facebook. We share a lot of details about the agency. We give insider information about some of the things that we do in the agency, and it's facebook.com/SlyFoxInvestigations. And our website, again, is SlyFoxInvestigations.com. So we look forward to interacting with you guys.
Well, Breanne Joseph, thank you so much for being with us. It's been an illuminating time for me, and I hope for our audience as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, Tony Soprano's mother, ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and of pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss. and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.